Hey, everybody, and welcome to this special episode of The Blind Ambition with Jack Kelly. It's your friend Rick from Blind, and today I have the great honor of introducing you all to Garima Sahai. Garima has spent nearly 20 years as a Google engineer. She was most recently the director of engineering of Google Local and Google Map Ads, where she was responsible for driving monetization for local intent in Google Search and Google Maps. In her role, she led a team of more than 100 engineers and product owners, user experience specialists, and analysts in the US and India. Chances are there's quite a few blind users that probably worked for you right now that are listening to this episode right now, Garima. At Google, she's also worked on Google Search as a technical lead manager and Google Books as a staff software engineer. Thanks for coming on the show, Garima.
Thank you, Rick, for the kind introduction. I'm excited to be here.
What I'm really curious about, how was it to be one of the first few women to get into tech early, spend 20 years going up the ladder at Google? It must have been just a really amazing experience, huh?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, Jack, because, you know, while you're going through that journey, sometimes you don't realize how different or unique it is. And again, growing up as a woman engineer back home in India, where I grew up and my early half of my life and career was, you ended up, I was in situations where I was one of the two women or five women or 10 women in a class of 100. And you ended up getting used to that kind of setup, and I would say you get numbed out. You don't realize you are different. You try to conform, you try to merge in. And I think at some level, I stopped noticing that I was, different. I was a woman in a crowd of a lot of men. I was just, another engineer trying or another student trying to learn. But now in retrospective, when I think about it, I think that was more of a survival mode. That's how you progress. That's how you get to the next step. And that's true for anything, not just gender, right? When we are in a group where we need to get to the next step, we kind of try to fit in and see what makes us grow. So yes, it was hard. It was difficult. I've had people tell me while in my academic journey saying that, girls are generally not that great at math. And those comments stick in your head. Or I went for a computer lab job at one time, and the professor there basically, he later I realized he was skeptical of girls joining that lab. And so he was asking us all those tough questions. And this is in my, I think, sophomore year of college, like what is cognition? What is AI? And at that time, those were really new concepts. And we couldn't answer them. And we felt like really, oh, we don't know computer science. But now I realize it was not on us. It was on the other party on trying to bring in more diversity or people who are interested in doing things into the crowd. Coming to the US, doing my master's here, it was also interesting when I joined Google, somebody walked up to me and said, hey, Garima, do you remember we were in the AI class together? And I didn't remember because, and then I was like, it's much easier to remember the girls in the class than the boys. It's just there are fewer of us. And I also didn't remember I was the only girl in that class. He told me that. And so that was an interesting comment. At Google, there were other women. I was one of the early engineers, and it was really exciting times. It was a small company. When I told my parents I'd gotten this offer from this company called Google, they didn't know what it was. So they were like, why aren't you joining something more stable, more, well-known like Microsoft, Oracle? And I had specialized in information retrieval and databases. And this company was doing something in information retrieval and databases. My first project was actually building a database for the Google Books project. And I was one of the two women on that team at that time. It was interesting times, amazing experience, lots of learning. My main reason to join that place was because it overlapped with my interest in computer science. And also at that time, I had an intention to do a PhD eventually, but I wanted a short job stint to kind of get financially more robust and then go into more learning. And that didn't happen because I thought I got multiple PhDs as a result of my career at Google, just interacting with multiple different smart people doing the projects that we did and having the impact that we had.
Now, I'm curious, you were one of the first engineers on Google Bugs. Within the tech world or the startup world especially, there's often kind of this concept of going from zero to one. Whereas I feel like at Google, you're going from zero, you're literally creating new product categories to 1 billion people. Can you talk about what it was like in the early days of, did this concept of like Google scale exist yet? Or were you just an engineer building and coding like normal?
That's a very good question, Rick, because I remember one of the things, and I came in as an engineer, you know, seeking to learn and do more things with what my expertise was in. But one of the first memories was there was a mail from Larry, I think, to the team. This project, the Google Books project, its origin actually goes back to Stanford. This was a digital libraries project, which Larry and Sergey were, I think, doing as part of their PhD project. And so one of the mails that Larry sent was like, hey, how many books can be there in the world? Let's do some back of the envelope calculation. So for example, if there are 50 million books, we are scanning at the pace of X, that should take more, at the most 5 years for us to scan the world's books, right? So this was the thinking that was coming in saying, okay, guys, how soon can you scan all the world's books and put it online for people to have access to? And so he was, and that's kudos to the founders. I think that was the, you know, mindset they were bringing to the table. And we were kind of doing this. Obviously, it was a lot more than 50 million books. We are still scanning in some libraries. We got some very interesting requests from places like monasteries on hills and in South Africa and you know, very random remote places where people were worried their manuscripts might get destroyed by fire, by you know, worms, and they wanted us to scan those things. It was really very broad, large scale project, which I think people didn't even realize when it was conceived that this is of the scale.
That's so wild. So that was like one of the first projects you work on, and you had both of the founders who were kind of running this. Just to give some perspective, when did Google get founded? Like, how was it? How many years ago?
So I think the official date is 1998, when I think it was still in the garage, in Susan's garage. And now that would make it close to 25 years. And I joined the company in 2003, July 2003. It had still not gone IPO. It was private. And there was around 600 or so engineers in the company at that time. So it was not like a tiny startup, but it was more like a mid-size. It had already started doing well. Ads had taken off and it was growing at a fast pace. The number of queries coming to Google was growing, but obviously my parents back in India hadn't heard of the company. So it hadn't reached that far yet. It was more of an academic, you know, more in the universities for research and stuff. But yeah, that was where it was at the time.
So 20 years later, do your parents finally say, oh, wow, you were working at a really great company. And did they say, hey, I apologize for doubting you, Karima, that, you know, we thought you were going, like, did they ever say, like, hey, your mom and I, you know, we were worried about you going to this place called Google when you could have been going to like JP Morgan or GM or IBM. And now they feel like, oh, wow, you made the right decision.
I think they got to know that pretty quickly, given the pace at which Google grew, like with my dad and my dad, who's no longer there, but he was super proud. Like he would refer to me as like, you know, if there is, and this is funny in back home in India, like sometimes people will ask questions and then they will say, oh, she works at Google, ask her. I'm like, I work at Google. I am not Google.
You know? You're not a search engine.
but you're right. It was interesting in those times because I was coming from a middle-class family in India. And when I got my offer at Stanford, I actually did not have a scholarship. And Stanford, as you know, is one of the most expensive schools out here. I had no clue if I was going to survive my master's here because I did not have enough funds beyond 2 months when I came to the US. I had to find a job. This was 2001, which was post the dot-com bust. So money was scarce outside in the market, also in academia. Funds were not coming in as usual. And so jobs were scarce too. And my first instinct was, oh, I need to get a job. Otherwise, I'm not going to be able to finish my program. So my first month here, I was basically going knocking on professors' doors and labs and stuff. Hey, guys, do you have any job that I could do? And it worked out in the end. I now, again, when I look back, I'm like, oh my gosh, those were some real celebrity professors. And I just walked into their offices asking them for a job. But again, I think this is my survival instinct. That's how I have gotten through some things earlier in life. And I got a job at Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, which paid for my tuition, and I had a stipend so I could, you know, work through my master's. And so for my parents, going back to the question, the thing was, hey, you know, you had to go through all these challenges. Are you in a stable place? They are basically looking out for me, and they are worried, like, you know, you don't want to be. And so they were more worried about, am I in a stable place? Will I be able to survive in a new country? You know, I was also one of the first kids, male or female in my generation, to come to the US as a migrant to study. And, you know, at that time, most of my family was back in India. So the people didn't know, you know, what to expect. I'm thankful to my parents. They trusted me enough to send me here. Actually, my dad and mom, they were both very supportive of me going out and learning as much as I can. And so US, of course, has one of the best higher education colleges. And so I think that trust helped them go through this. And of course, both me and them were rewarded thanks to how Google performed.
That's so. So you came, did you know anybody here? Or you just said to your parents, hey, I want to go to the US. I want to go to Stanford. I want to be, you know, in the tech industry. And you just went for it, huh?
Yeah, I didn't know a lot of people. I had one uncle who had actually also come here for his grad studies in the 80s, early 80s to Arizona. And he was the only one. And he's the one who said, if you get into Stanford, you go to Stanford. That was his thinking. I got into a lot of good school, you know, UC, Wisconsin. They're all great schools. And I got scholarships too. So I had fun. And I wasn't more interested in going to a place where I had the funds. But then he was the one who convinced me to come to Stanford. Other than him and his family, I didn't know anybody here. My dad was actually, I think my dad was a very, he was an academic himself, although he ended up in government services in India. He always had a strong love for learning. And when he was in his universities and colleges, his professors had gone to Stanford, had gone to MIT, and he had this charm of these huge academic institutions, which were, you know, he felt like they had a lot to offer in terms of learning. So he was really supportive and excited about me going to. I remember him saying once, if you need to go to Mars to learn the best you can, I will support you. So that, you know, that was the kind, that is awesome. And it helped me. On the flip side, I actually did not know that I wanted to do tech. I was good at math when I was in my school. I was good at STEM, and I performed very well. And in India, if you perform well in academics, you are popular. And second, you have you have kind of a few paths chosen for you in terms of, because that's the thing. I think when you're coming from places where the basic things are not as easily available, your first goal is to get to a place where you don't have to worry about the necessities. So get to a financially stable place, get to a place in a career where you don't have to worry about the day-to-day. And for those kinds of careers, since I was so good at my general academia stuff, it was kind of ordained that either I'm going to be an engineer or a doctor. And my inclination in math and physics was much higher. Actually, physics was my favorite subject. And so engineering was the path. That was the choice. And then again, the next step gets easier because among engineering colleges, there are only a few which are really good at those. So if you are good at your scores, you end up going to one of those engineering colleges. And in engineering, of all the streams, computer science was the more up and coming. That's the one where you get better jobs. Tech is where you get more for the skills you bring to the table. So computer science became, I did program In my high school, actually in India, this is interesting. My kids are going to public school here, and I'm noticing that this is 20 years later. The kids are learning programming at a, I would say, slower and later stage in their lives than I learned 20 years back in India. So I was exposed to programming in my middle school, and then in my high school, I was doing C++. So I did get exposed to it, but it was not like, I hear a lot of the people say that it became the love of their life at that time, and they knew this is what they wanted to do. For me, tech always, it was interesting. I like the fundamental parts more, the algorithms, the data structures, you know, the core. I was more of a theoretical computer science person. But what was most exciting about tech was its power to solve problems for a lot of, so, you know, people. It's the scale at which it could solve problems, and the magic that happens when you're actually able to apply tech to a problem. So that was the most exciting part that kept me going in this direction.
Now, I'm curious, right? Because very few people kind of do well in terms of going to a startup where things are kind of unstructured or unclear, right? You noted kind of growing up, there was always this kind of like pattern of like leveling up, or there's a certain career path or a ladder or expectation for you. Do you have any advice for people who kind of have that similar background or that similar comfort level where they're in a completely new environment and they have to figure out, oh, well, how do I keep myself motivated and how do I level up my own career if there's no kind of set format that someone's going to lay out for me?
Yeah, I'm going to offer my perspective here. I do acknowledge that there are lots of perspective, and mine might not be the best for yours, for an individual situation. But I would, again, like you said, based on where I've come from, where I have been, and where I am, my perspective here is that the leveling up needs to be personalized, right? Your notion of success needs to be your own. That is, I feel like, and this is something which came to me a little later in my career. And sometimes I feel like, what would I have told a younger Garima, which would have been more powerful? Because I felt like some of my own confidence, my own growth came after I realized this, that success is not what the world lays out for me. Like, hey, you get to position X, or you get to salary X, or you get to company Y in a certain amount of time. It's about how I think about what a better version of myself or a better version of my life looks like. And for me, when I actually tried to lay that out, it was, again, one about learning. What new things have I learned? And how I have been able to apply them for a greater good. And that greater good, it doesn't need to be really altruistic. It could be even for my kids, for my family, for the people around me, for my community, or even for myself. Like, you know, am I able to bring more value to the table when I am on a table due to that learning? So that was one aspect. The second part was about, is the work that I'm doing, is it generating the kind of impact that brings me joy? So I think, again, my definition, and these are some, these are slightly subjective. We can go a level down in them, but I started defining success in those ways. And I'm sure there'll be lots of people who might be wondering, oh, she was at Google for 20 years. She became a director. Oh, she could have been a VP. She could have become X in this time. She must have a network because she started so early. She must know X, Y, Z. But to be honest, that was not how I was defining success for myself. And then secondly, when I joined Google, the people around me, Rick, it was awesome, actually. The people around me, they were, and it was also an earlier time, they were all about solving a hard problem, having fun while doing it, really smart people. And I think I learned that. And I was talking about a lady who was also in tech, a woman engineer with me earlier. And she was she had done her chemistry master's from MIT long while back. She was in her 50s. And she was programming because she enjoyed that. She enjoyed solving problems by coding. And having such people around me, I think, really inspired me to focus more on that fun, learning, and impact than worrying about where am I going to get to next and how. And to be honest, I think that has been a really, it has brought me a lot of joy and contentment. I've never really regretted not doing X because I could have become Y, because I feel like I was always learning something new, having fun while doing it, solving a hard problem.
You know, I love that you share this with us, because oftentimes here in the US, and you've been here 20 plus years now, so you've seen it, there's this pressure on people. You know, you have to succeed. You have to earn X amount of money. And then once you earn that money, you have to have more money, and you have to have a higher title, and you have to do this. And it's like this treadmill that you never get off of. And these people never seem to be happy, never seem to be fulfilled. But as you're pointing out, is that, and I think I agree with you on this, and I know Rick, I think he agrees as well, is that you want to find a job that has purpose, that has meaning, that gives you fulfillment, that makes you happy. So maybe you're not going to make as much as someone else. So what? It's not about that. It's about your own journey, your own life, right? It's what gives you satisfaction, what gets you up in the morning, what gets you out of the bed to feel that you're doing something important, useful, and you're impacting people in a good way.
Yeah. And let me just also add a little bit of caveat here. I do acknowledge I'm speaking from a place of privilege here. And, you know, when you have a certain, I mean, I joined Google, I can see people saying, oh, she joined Google so early, the stock did well, she didn't have to worry about money at that stage. You know, what do you do when you have a family? You have to make sure you have food on the table, you have get right education for your kids. That's a very valid concern. So what I'm saying here is not to nullify or minimize thinking about compensation, title, getting to a role which can enable you to cater to the necessities or what you need in terms of you and your family needs to make happen. But I think we somewhere in our journey, we lose sight of what was need and what's just become a race. So I do encourage people to take a step back and define for themselves. And again, needs can be different for different individuals, different families. What their needs, just like they would define success, define what needs are. And needs have this habit of growing as you grow in your career. The more you have, your needs might grow. It's a good thing to do it early in your career. Say, hey, this is what I think I need. And after that, things might be a bonus, which is great. And I'll do more with it. But let those things not define how I trade off my definition of success or fulfillment. I think that will be a useful thing for all of us to do at some point.
Yeah, I think that's such a good reminder, right? Because it's very easy to go on blind and see how much other people are making, or think like, oh gosh, like why haven't I gotten there, right? Or why did I know about this sooner, right? Like I think one of the kind of most powerful moments and most dangerous moments about blind is you go on and you instantly have these like aha moments of like, oh wow, like I didn't know this, or I can't believe I'm like in the know about this, or I can get connected to this. But it almost becomes kind of this like cycle that you can't really get off of, right? Because I always call it like first principles, right? If you start from somewhere with like first principles and like understanding what you truly value, then you often don't get caught up in this kind of like cycle of follow me or like keeping up with the Joneses, whatever you want to call it. I'm curious. I know that you've mentioned that just this pursuit of knowledge and just this like intense interest in kind of technology has always been kind of like your core values. Along the way, along your career, have you found your values changing in terms of what keeps you motivated? And how have you kind of responded to that kind of change, if any?
That's a very good question, Rick. Actually, I have been thinking about it recently too. I feel like the past 4 or 5 years have been kind of dramatic for me personally and professionally. I think part of it is also the world went through a drastic change with COVID. And, you know, we all got a little bit of a shocker to take a step back and think what is important in life and not. And one of the things I think I realized about myself as part of this was I find inequity and injustice really triggering. And I feel like this might have something to do with all those years of suppressed emotions or numbness that I used to survive in where there might have been inequities. You know, somebody telling you that X, just because you were born X, cannot be good at math is not the right thing to hear ever. But I didn't care about it at that time. And I think a lot of these things came out. I was hearing about the conversation going out on about racial injustice, a beginning of COVID, a lot around us. There were things around Asian hate and violence that happened, which was also, and then there were recent things that were happening, whether it be in the government and recently like with the Supreme Court decisions and stuff like that. A lot of stuff I realized that besides my love for learning and technology, I cared about my fellow people, my fellow human beings, and I felt wrong. And this, some of these things were touching us a lot in tech too, in terms of, do we have equity in pay? Do we have equal access to opportunities? And it's not just about gender, it's about any segment of society or humanity trying to get to something. And I think I saw a new purpose in my work. I felt like, you know, now, I've been doing tech to solve big problems, and I'm so thankful Google gave me that platform, those products which touch so many people's lives, and I could contribute in some part to it. But I felt like I felt a stronger purpose at this time to do something more direct in terms of trying to use my expertise and experience to solve some of these social things that are happening around me. I started engaging a lot more in DEI conversations. I was leading a DEI group in my organization for inclusion and equity. I started participating in some of the volunteer projects for women in tech, mentorship and enabling. And also more recently, I engaged with Google.org to see how we can use tech to enable more nonprofits. Because again, it's about scale, right? And how can we bring the tools and the mindset that more people, and there are so many people trying to do good work around us, that they can go faster, they can go bigger. That's how I'm thinking about it. I mean, if you guys have opinions, ideas, yeah, suggestions, I'm open.
I would imagine, and this might sound a little crass in part, because of what's happening in the economy and a lot of good people who've lost their jobs or worried about losing their jobs. And I think when you have an economy that's kind of shaky, people start reevaluating, just like during the pandemic. So I would imagine there are a lot of like-minded people like yourself, Garima, who might say, hey, Garima, if you're doing this, you know, I'm a software engineer doing X, I'd be interested. And then somebody else might say, hey, I'm a product manager, so I could help get it out there. Another person, I'm a chief marketing officer in between jobs, I would be happy to do it. So I wonder if this, and they say like a lot of great companies came during recessionary times. So it could be, yeah, that's either you join a larger, you know, Goodwill type of, or Code America, or, you know, you have a like-minded people that build a cool app like you were talking about in the public schools or something else. This might be the right time. This sounds exciting.
Definitely, you're spot on. Just from my, by the way, I am still relatively new to social media and LinkedIn, yeah, and whatnot. But after my post there, I got so many messages. I was actually blown away. Along the same theme that you're mentioning, Jack, because people were like, hey, Garima, can we just exchange ideas? There was the startups who are trying to do something, and they're like, hey, would you be willing to advise on something here? Because we are trying to figure this out. Or there are other people who are like, hey, we are thinking about this problem. And I was blown away in both ways. There's so many people trying to do good in some way or the other, whether it's climate and sustainability, whether it's education, you know, bringing jobs to people. But there is also this sudden richness in the pool of people, yeah, yeah, who have the expertise and the time. And, you know, so you're right. I think
It's the time. I think it's right. It's everything is gelling together because you have enough people now either who are in between roles, or they're worried about it being in between roles, or they realize life is just too short. I got to do something, as you said at the beginning of the show, that has meaning and purpose and value. If I'm going to spend my time doing something, I'd rather do that, you know, and make an impact. And yeah, so I think this could be a good time for you. This could be really interesting.
Yeah. Yep. And I wish the same for many other people who are doing different things right now. It's, you know, life has just given us this chance to think differently, do differently, learn differently, and add more value again. So yeah, and I would also encourage people to think of themselves from a place of value, because that's something that happens, right? When you have gone through a job change or you've been laid off, you might question where you can bring value. Are your skills really needed anymore, or where they would might be a good fit? I would take this time to introspect and really see. For example, I know there are places where I might not, I would say that, for example, my business sense might not be at the same level as my interest and expertise in technology. You know, different people bring different. I think it's a great time for us to introspect, but also believe that there are some things we really can bring value to and know our strengths and actually lead with them. I think that's a difference I'm noticing in my approach, and also in how I'm getting received by people. Is once I have had the chance to introspect on what my strengths are and where I want to go, I it reflects back. So that's how, so I wish the same for all other people who are around and looking for things and exploring, go with that. And I wish them the very best.
Thanks for your wisdom. I think I really appreciate that perspective, because it's not one that we hear too often in tech, right? I almost feel like there's almost kind of like a very like individualistic kind of motivation that a lot of people have, right? And they kind of forget that like tech is actually like a force for good, and it has historically been that way.
Yes.
So I really appreciate you coming on the show to remind us of that.
So I will share this one quote, because I think that has really, it captures a lot of what I'm trying to say, is the meaning of life is to find your gift, and the purpose of life is to give it away. And so this is my wish for everybody. You know, I truly believe we all have gifts to offer. I hope you find that gift, and I hope you figure the right place to give it away.
Beautiful. That's a great way to wrap. That's perfect. Thank you so much.
That's it for The Blind Ambition. If you enjoyed the show, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.